Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio, this fine day in November. It's actually the 30th of November. It's a wonderful blue day. There's a touch of frost on the grass. It's not a cloud in the sky. Sun's sparkling on the water. It's fantastic. It's really, really beautiful. Anyway, this morning I was thinking about boundaries. And my mind was going back over some academic work I did years ago, decades ago in fact, on this very topic. And I got really absorbed into this thing. And I did write quite a long dissertation on this topic. It was about 24,000 words or something. And I covered the works of Quine, Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, Lao Tzu, and a few others in the general consideration. And my mind was just going over that, and I was sort of dredging around in the memory banks. And wondering if there was anything coherent left in there of this topic. It is something that keeps coming up, particularly if one thinks about such things as yoga, or money, or society, or class, or gender, or things in general, objects. So in a way, I've been running with that ever since. And I say it's been some decades. So what I'm going to attempt today is it's going to be a bit rambly, because I am dredging around in ancient archives in the back of my addled old brain. But there's a question: what is the nature of the boundaries that we perceive and that we use conceptually? And the question that I asked all those years ago is, well, are they made by us? Or do they have some status separate from our consciousness? Or our perception or our conceptualisation? And I kind of did come to the conclusion that Nietzsche was right about this, and that they came from us. And this was my first deep dig into Nietzsche. I actually just confined my considerations to one chapter out of the Will to Power, and it was a chapter called "The Will to Power is Knowledge." Now, we should say about the book "The Will to Power" that it was concocted from Nietzsche's notes by his sister after his death. And there was a project on Nietzsche's part to produce a magnum opus, which would possibly be called The Will to Power. And there's a lot of questions amongst the exegetes of Nietzsche and Nietzsche scholars as to the exact status of this work. But certainly some fascinating material in what are, after all, notebooks. I actually find very often that artists' sketchbooks and philosophers' notebooks are kind of more fruitful as a stimuli for me, personally, than the finished works and the big public statements. I mean, the thing in The Will to Power as Knowledge is that interpretation is the primordial thing that the human the human being does. And nature actually floats quite close to pragmatism epistemologically in this chapter, The Will to Power as Knowledge. And pragmatism says basically that truth is what is useful, and that the term truth is a congratulatory term, that we give to propositions that prove very useful to us. And that, I mean, this is quite crude, but basically pragmatism goes along those lines. Now, it does hit problems. If you read Bertrand Russell on John Dewey, who's one of the classic pragmatists. Now, pragmatism was an American school. People like Dewey, Pierce was the grandfather of it, William James, and so on. And there's a pragmatic feel to much later American philosophy. You can feel it in Richard Rorty's work, for instance, and Hilary Putnam to a certain extent. There's still this kind of feel to it. So, if the way we apprehend the world is driven by interest, by our kind of species interest as well as our individual interest, and is limited by the extent to which our senses pick up information from the world. I mean, just for instance, human beings don't perceive ultraviolet or infrared. Other creatures do. Some creatures, they don't have colour vision. We have colour vision. We have binocular colour vision. But a fly has a compound eye, and it's just the way the information is delivered to the processing parts of the organism of a fly is kind of quite different from the way it's delivered to a human being. This is a point made by Kolakowski, who was one of the philosophers I worked on when I was doing this work on boundaries. Anyway, the upshot, if I can stop digressing, the upshot is that boundaries are made by us, if nature is right. And that we carve the world up in a particular way that's suited to our interest. I mean, Nietzsche had a way of putting this. He said that we interpret both the phenomenal world, in other words, the world of our inwardness, and the external world, under the imperative of the will to power. He saw the will to power as this interpretative mechanism. Within the human being that was responsible for the sense that we make of the world. And nature included interesting concepts like cause and effect, the whole apparatus of logic, notions like truth, notions like ego. All of these are included under this understanding as they are seen as interpretations under the imperative of this drive, this primordial drive, the will to power. Of course, well, how would we know this? And somebody like Kolakowski is trying to draw conclusions from the different sensory apparatus of different creatures. Nietzsche doesn't kind of quite go there, but he is a little bit biologistic in his thinking on this matter. Now, and so, you know, how would Nietzsche know? But still, the question's still lurking. But still, the question is still hovering. How would Nietzsche know this? And the way I understood, eventually, what Nietzsche was doing in this chapter was to see that he was engaging in disruption as much as anything else, as a hermeneutics of suspicion. It was almost a kind of a what if. Well, actually, what if it's like this? And of course, it's not implausible. We know that our senses are limited. And we do actually know that there are different ways, even for us, to cut up the world into, in other words, to impose a schema of boundaries onto the world. We don't just have the common sense one, we have some other ones. And this is the significance of the Dionysian in Nietzsche, because in the Dionysian, as Nietzsche describes it, particularly in his early formulations, but which you find in The Birth of Tragedy, Out of the Spirit of Music. And the Dionysian, on this take, is that kind of sense of merging, of the boundaries melting, of the orgiast, the Dionysiac worshipper, the orgiast melting into the community in the great intoxicated orgy of Dionysian worship. Or the sense of merging into the cosmos of classic mystical experience and yoga experience. Nietzsche was had some familiarity with this. And of course that puts that question mark of suspicion over our common sense boundaries, which we place around the objects and the concepts that we use, all the more convincing. I mean, it's not implausible what he's saying. Presumably, an organism sees what it can see, feels what it can feel, understands what it can understand, within some sense of limit. Another philosopher who I drew on was an American logician called Smullyan, Raymond Smullyan. And Smullyan draws attention to the great swirling dissolution of boundaries into a whole of flux and swirl. And it sounds like he'd had some acquaintance with those experiences. Even though you kind of think of logicians as being a bit immune to that stuff, but not in his case. And that kind of, I suppose, gave me my initial impetus, right, even more than Nietzsche. It was just Smullyan just mentioning this great swirling of the boundaries. Now, what it does mean, if this is right, and I'm prepared to kind of run with this, to be honest with you, is that, and particularly conceptual boundaries, that they've got a certain movability, and we can actually move them about if we want to, for purposes of our own. And certainly an approach that I take when I'm trying to appraise the stories we hear about life, the world, current affairs, history, structure of society and so on, is to look at the boundaries that are being imposed on the analytical apparatus that we bring to bear on these such considerations. So I'm trying to figure out the state of the world economy, or the state of the global culture, or something like that. first thing I would do is look at the accounts that are current in the popular discourse, and look at the conceptual boundaries that are being applied. Look at the concepts that are being applied. Now, the concept of nation, well, that implies a certain boundary. Well, can we do something with that boundary? Can we put the boundary itself under question? Can we shift it? Could we, for instance, if we were considering philosophy of history? And certainly for a long time, history was taught in British schools and universities as the comings and goings of kings and queens, of the powerful, and of laws and wars and so forth, big events and big power players. But that depends, that our whole approach depends on really simply taking for granted that these are the significant boundaries between kings and queens and the rest of the people. And then some kind of endowment of significance on the basis of that boundary. But why not say, well, what about women's history? Or working class history? And of course, what you do there is you shift the boundaries that you take to be significant, and then proceed with your investigations. Start looking at the archives where they're relevant to women. Start looking at archaeological remains where they're relevant to women. Start reading the fiction of an era that you're interested in with the fiction maybe that's written by women or about women, etc., etc. And so you can write a women's history as well as a conservative history of kings and queens, or a working class history. And you might look at the boundary around a nation, but then realise that there's a tribe in that nation which spreads across several neighbouring nations, like the Kurds or somebody like that. And so you could shift the boundary again. Now, we can do this with all sorts of things. We can do this with all sorts of things, and it boils down to being critical about the categorisations, both conceptual and to do with objects and institutions that are being used in any particular situation. We should put like a scrutiny over it. And it seems to me that the way the world is cut up, once we do criticism, has very often got an ideological character, or is very often, and or, is very often employed unthinkingly in a kind of off-the-peg fashion. I think the job of philosophers is to dig a bit deeper. As Nietzsche said, most people lay the spade down too soon. Dig a little deeper. Why did you stop here? Why did you stop here? And it would be that taunt from Nietzsche that should encourage us to kind of look at the boundaries that we're employing. Look at the categories we're employing. Look at where we draw in the lines in the basically swirling mass of information which is consciousness in the raw before we start to interpret, and which somebody like Smullyan apprehended, or which you can apprehend through certain drugs or intoxicated states or mystical practices or dancing or sometimes just spontaneously, the Dionysian. So I suppose what I'm trying to say, and what came out for me from this work, was that, well, okay, I've got a really great critical tool here. I can paint the world with different palettes according to the boundary structure I wish to impose onto the conceptual frameworks I'm using to interpret, appraise, evaluate that which is of interest to me. And maybe that which I want to actively intervening. So I think that investigation did give me useful tools for thinking and analysing. The other thing I think it did, which is significant, is really underscore the profound significance of the Dionysian. And there's not many people who are considering that in this way, from what I can see. A few Nietzsche scholars, but even they sort of hesitate to talk about this stuff. And the psychedelicists, I suppose. But the psychedelicist philosophers are kind of a pretty varied bunch, and they spot other things in this matter of the swirling dissolution of boundaries. But nevertheless, I think that these experiences and their cognitive import is underscored. Another thing which jumped out at me at the time, and which jumps out at me even more vividly these days, is that these boundary configurations are ideological in character, very often. We use a set of categories to analyse a situation, but that set of categories carries with it a world view and a sectional interest, often. I mean, for instance, historically, Brahmins were very keen to take the Chaturvana, the forecasts, as being very real boundaries. They're in fact boundaries imposed upon a society or a community that were inscribed in the very nature of the universe itself and in divinity. These were part of the of the great world soul. The servant class were the feet of the great world soul, and the Brahmins were the head of the great world soul, and so on. So it says an ideological character, in as much as the people imposing the boundaries are the ones most likely to profit in terms of wealth, power and influence from the imposition of that boundary schema. So you see that immediately the boundary schema carries interest, carries ideology, and of course ideology is very often takes on this form of representing a certain boundary set as a part of the natural order or the order of things or something that's inevitable and irreversible or even as divinely ordained. And this is not unusual. Remember the famous hymn, "All things bright and beautiful," nice Victorian hymn. The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high and low, each to his own estate. And there you get it, you see, there's boundaries, class boundaries, the rich man, the poor man, estates, and the whole thing vouched for by God himself. In other words, you know, you don't question it. Of course, Nietzsche's thing was to question quite a lot of accepted things. And that is one of the great analytic gifts that we've got here with this notion of the lability of boundaries. We can actually question them. Of course, this is also the meaning of God is dead. If God is dead, none of these supposedly fixed boundary schemas are in fact fixed. There's no God to vouch for them. we can start moving them. We can start thinking differently. We can start painting other pictures of our situation in various respects. So boundaries. If you're one of those people who thinks about stuff, it's always a good place to start when you've got a conundrum. What boundaries are functioning here in this discourse that I'm questioning is what you ask. Of course, you have boundaries around concepts, boundaries around values, boundaries around things in the world and in society and in history and in the cosmos, as well as abstract conceptual boundaries. They're all actually up for grabs. You can start playing with them. And that's a very straightforward and highly pregnant way of painting different pictures and getting different perspectives on situations. Because you don't need to confine yourself to one perspective in your researches. Also, I would be saying to you, ask the question, what ideological function is being served by this particular boundary schema? That's always useful as well. Anyway, have fun with that, and thanks for listening.